time, VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. U.S. President Donald Trump's administration on Wednesday appeared to abandon its proposed freeze on hundreds of billions of dollars in domestic aid amid legal setbacks and widespread opposition. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
The White House Budget Office told federal agencies it was rescinding a memo that had ordered them to pause a wide swath of grant and loan payments. But officials said they still planned to block funding for activities opposed by President Donald Trump. At a White House event, Trump said his administration had already identified and defunded unnecessary foreign aid programs.
We are merely looking at parts of the big bureaucracy where there has been tremendous waste and fraud and abuse.
The proposed spending freeze threw the government into turmoil and disrupted payments to medical and child care providers before it was temporarily blocked by a federal judge.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. President Trump says he has a new use for Guantanamo Bay. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The U.S. base in Cuba has been used to house terror detainees. The president's ordering the opening of a detention center there to hold illegal immigrants.
We're going to send them out to Guantanamo.
And says the facility will hold up to 30,000 migrants.
This will double our capacity.
The president made the remarks moments before signing his administration's first law, named after Lakin Riley, a Georgia nursing student killed last year by an illegal immigrant. The law mandates those in the U.S. illegally and accused of violent crimes be detained and potentially deported even before conviction. Sagar Magani, Washington.
This is VOA News. Former U.S. Senator Bob Menendez was sentenced Wednesday to 11 years in prison for his conviction for accepting bribes of gold and cash and acting as an agent of Egypt, crimes his own lawyer said earned him the nickname Gold Bar Bob. AP correspondent Haya Panduani reports.
Judge Sidney H. Stein announced the sentence after Menendez tearfully addressed the judge, saying he'd lost everything he cared about. Prosecutors sought a 15-year term for the Democrat convicted of crimes, including acting as an agent of the Egyptian government. Two New Jersey businessmen convicted with Menendez were sentenced earlier to 7 and 8 years in prison. I'm Haya Panjwani.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Donald Trump's pick to lead the top U.S. health agency, came under attack for his anti-vaccine views at a contentious Senate confirmation hearing on Wednesday. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen reports.
Here's an exchange he had with Democratic Senator Ron Wyden.
I support the measles vaccine. I support the polio vaccine. I will do nothing as HHS secretary that makes it difficult or discourages people from taking it.
Anybody who believes that on a look at the measles book you wrote saying parents have been misled into believing that measles is a deadly disease, that's not true.
Democratic senators brought up a string of past statements from Kennedy, including that COVID-19 was targeted to attack Caucasians and black people. Kennedy has also decried the U.S. food industry for adding ingredients he says make Americans less healthy, and received a stern response to some of his statements from Republican Senator Chuck Grassley.
I expect you to leave agricultural practice regulations to the proper agencies.
While other Republican senators expressed support for Kennedy during and after the hearing.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. The leader of Syria's rebels who overthrew President Bashar al-Assad last month was named interim president on Wednesday. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
Ahmad al-Shara once led an Islamist insurgent group that was affiliated with al-Qaeda, but it has denounced its former ties in recent years. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham led the fighting that toppled Assad in December, and al-Shara will lead Syria during the country's transitional phase. A spokesman says Syria's constitution, adopted in 2012 under Assad's rule, has been canceled, and that al-Shara will have the authority to form a temporary legislative council until a new constitution is drafted. I'm Donna Water.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The city of Goma in eastern DRC was slowly returning to some normalcy on Wednesday under M23 control.
Well, it was a new day since the M23 took the control of the city of Goma, because we saw some activities started in the city of Goma. Some shops opened their doors, especially pharmacy.
African Union demands a halt to the fighting in eastern DRC amid regional peace efforts. Guinea's military junta demands a January 31st deadline for political parties to hold conventions or be banned. A look at the impact on Africa of the 90-day pause on U.S. foreign aid. ECOWAS vows to review its policies and improve its successes and challenges as three members lead the sub-regional body.
Even though the three countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, have officially left today, there are still many issues to be resolved.
And President Trump pushes to end birthright citizenship. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Heads of State of the East African Community and the Southern African Development Community, SADC, issued a joint statement Wednesday. It calls on all parties in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo conflict to cease hostilities and observe an immediate and unconditional ceasefire. The leaders, meeting virtually, also called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict. Meanwhile, reporter Sabiti Jaffa in Goma tells me that life in the Eastern DRC city was slowly returning to some normalcy on Wednesday, but under M23 control.
Well, the 29th of January was a new day since the M23 took the control of the city of Goma, because we saw some activities started in the city of Goma. Some shops opened their door, especially pharmacy. Many people went to pharmacies to pay drug because, during this fighting, many people were wounded, and some of them didn't have any opportunity to go to the hospital. And with the intensity of fightings, many people were not only injured but got sick because of stress. And pharmacies today opened and got a lot of customers. I saw also the public transportation working, such as motorbike and some taxis. And for the first time since the war, we saw many people in roads, many people walking, speaking, laughing, loudly. So this shows that life starts returning in the city of Goma.
How true is it that some mercenaries have turned themselves in to the Rwandan government?
It's true. 289 mercenaries was allowed by M23 to return back in their country via the border of Rwanda. These white mercenaries were working with FRDC as instructors, trainers, and sometimes they were also involved in fighting alongside FRDC during this war. They surrendered the day that Goma fell under M23 control, and now MONUSCO supervised their departure to Rwanda. When taking them to the border between DRC and Rwanda, the spokesperson of M23, the colonel William Goma, told them that no one can defeat M23 because you came here to fight for money, but we as M23 are fighting for our life. We are fighting for our future. We are fighting for our generation and our kids.
There are also reports that some Goma citizens who had crossed into Rwanda had begun to return to Goma.
Some citizens of DRC who fled the war in Rwanda started to return back in Goma today, because the M23 had already organized the service of migration at the border between DRC and Rwanda here in Goma. I saw also a movement of people leaving Goma, going to Gisenyi. This shows that the border is now open between Rwanda and DRC under the control of M23.
That was reporter Jaffa Katanti speaking with us from Goma, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. What happened to the millions of internally displaced people who were already in and around the eastern DRC city of Goma before it fell to the M23 rebels this week. Reporter Eddie Isango of VOA's French and Lingala services collected the testimony of Patsy Mumbalama, the coordinator of the NGO Action and Development Initiative for the Protection of Women and Children.
So most of IDPs who were in IDPs camp in Rusayo, Ushagala, and all those IDPs around Goma, they are now in the town in Goma, and the situation is really very, very difficult for them. So without water, electricity, food, so they are exposed to so many risks of disease. And it's urgent for them, to find the support, not only for us as non-profit organizations, but also, I can't say from the Congolese government, because now I'm sensitive there. They have to make sure that internal displaced and even people here in Goma can have access to their basic needs, like to water, food. But, the situation is really very, very difficult for most of Congolese now.
Many inhabitants of Goma fled to Gisenyi, some to Bukavu, and the IDPS were living in schools or outside. What about them? Did they flee or are they still in the town, the city?
Most of them are still in the town because it was difficult for most of IDPs to go to Bukavu or to Gisenyi, because Gisenyi is a little bit far from where most of IDP's camp are. So most of them are still in the town. They are in school, church, but there are an important need, for water, food, and it's really hard because the two last day, the situation was really very, very difficult, and most of people are still in the town. It's difficult to go to Bukavu, to Ruchuru or Sake because, the access is really very difficult because of the fighting which was going on. But now they are in different schools and church, and the situation is really very, very difficult.
Patsy Mumbalama is the coordinator of the NGO Action and Development Initiative for the Protection of Women and Children. She spoke with reporter Eddie Isango of VOA's French and Lingala services. The African Union has called for an immediate halt to the fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and urged a dialogue to resolve the escalating conflict. On Wednesday, the U.S. Embassy in DRC advised Americans not to travel to the country. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Calm returned to Kinshasa on Wednesday, a day after protests over M23's capture of Goma in eastern Congo. Angry youths set fire to the embassies of Belgium, France, Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda. The protesters accused those countries of supporting Rwanda, which Kinshasa accuses of backing the M23 rebels. Kigali denies the charge. The embassies either condemned or expressed deep concern over the attacks. Chacha Nyaigoti Chacha, a Kenyan expert in international relations and diplomacy, says he does not think the protests will affect the DRC's relation with the affected countries.
I don't think it will affect the relationship at the level of policy and the decision makers. Because right now, they should deal with that as an act of criminals. And those who were responsible for vandalizing and burning down the property of the other nations should be pursued through the legal means.
According to some residents who spoke to VOA, Goma is calm after 2 days of heavy fighting. Residents who ventured out Wednesday saw bodies on the streets, some in military uniforms and others in civilian clothes. The U.S. government announced Tuesday it has closed its embassy in Kinshasa to the public and called on its citizens to review their safety and travel plans. African Union and other regional bodies have called for a cessation of hostilities and for the M23 rebel group to withdraw from the city, a move security experts say will be difficult for the rebel group to accept. This African Community regional bloc has called for the summit to discuss the conflict and address the tension between DR Congo and Rwanda. According to the Congolese state media, President Felix Tshisekedi will not attend the talks. Crispin Mvano is a Congolese political and security researcher in Goma. He says Kinshasa will also need to address and solve its internal problems. The conflict in DR Congo isn't just about disputes with other countries. It also stems from internal divisions among the Congolese people. Even as the talks continue in Nairobi, lasting stability depends on resolving these internal issues. If Congolese leaders and communities don't engage in dialogue and address their differences in Kinshasa, the peace talks alone are unlikely to bring real stability, Vano says. DR Congo is home to over 100 armed groups, many fighting for control of resources and mining areas. In the latest conflict, the Congolese army and the allied Wazalendo militia retreated from the city, with some soldiers surrendering at the UN peacekeeping base in Goma. Great Lakes Region security analyst Dismas Nkunda says Kinshasa needs to build a strong army to confront rebels like the M23.
M23, they are very well equipped. And how does that impact on the kind of victories that they are attaining in DRC?
Congolese Foreign Minister Therese Kayikwama Wagner said in an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday that more than 500,000 people in eastern Congo were displaced this month and that the humanitarian situation there is getting worse. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Voice of America, I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 30th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. An official of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, says democracy remains a core value of the regional body. At the same time, Abdel Fattah Moussa, ECOWAS Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security, says the regional body wants to understand what drove Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger to leave ECOWAS. The three countries formally withdrew from the organization on Wednesday. Fattah Moussa tells me that ECOWAS, which celebrates 50 years of its founding this year, vows to review its policies and improve its successes and challenges.
Today is something like a historical day in the regional integration project. You know, so leaving them, it is just a feeling of sadness and that psychological trauma that will be brought to bear on the populations of West Africa. You know, you ask your question, what does it mean? The thing is that the heads of state and government of ECOWAS are very concerned about the fate of our peoples. So even though the three countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, have officially left today, there are still many issues to be resolved in terms of assets and liabilities and what will happen to them in the future.
Is ECOWAS doing any kind of internal soul searching in terms of what went wrong?
Listen, that is very much part of the ECOWAS activities going forward. Remember, this is the 50th anniversary of ECOWAS. ECOWAS was founded in 1975. This is exactly 50 years. In May, it will be 50 years. This anniversary, even though traumatic as it is, 50 years after its inception, we are arrived at the crossroads. The heads of state have also requested that the soul searching that you are talking about, that we engage in a strategic review of the entire regional integration project, and then to see over the years, and ECOWAS has got a lot of successes over the past 50 years, whether it's in conflict resolution, whether it's in mediation, whether it's in strengthening democratic culture in the countries, and the best of all, infrastructure development. So there is a lot to be proud of. Meanwhile, there are also some challenges that we have in terms of adding substance to formal democracy, the situation of the populations, what has gone wrong. We have got a very young population in West Africa. Why are they still not being integrated effectively into the regional integration project? These are all questions that we have to ask.
Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, all three are led by military governments. Is this a setback for ECOWAS's push for continued democracy in the region?
Definitely, it's a problem for the region. The region has made a strategic choice for democracy, for leaders to be elected through the ballot box, and that remains a core value of ECOWAS. So military intervention is an aberration today. But then we need to understand what were the causal factors for these coups and how to prevent them in the future.
Abdel Fattah Moussa is the new Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security for the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. The U.S. 90-day pause on foreign aid has sparked widespread concern among aid organizations and affected communities in needy regions. The suspension reduced funding for critical programs that address hunger, health, and education. For more on the impact on Africa, VOA's Douglas Umpuga reached political analyst David Moda.
It's really going to be a big problem. In particular, the PEPFAR program, which was covering AIDS relief to Africa, that's the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, started under the Bush administration, providing antiretroviral medications for millions. The reason the Trump administration is doing this is they want to realign who they give aid to with American interests and values. But the challenge is a lot of that aid money to healthcare was relied upon by many African governments as a large part of their public health sector funding. And it's really going to create major gaps in terms of funding for healthcare in many parts of the continent, but also in many parts of the developing world.
Some people have argued that maybe this should be a wake-up call for African governments not to heavily rely on foreign aid. What do you make of that?
I totally agree. And I would go further and say it's actually one of the inherent contradictions of some of this aid we get from abroad. If you think about PEPFAR, before PEPFAR, African governments used to spend on healthcare. But one of the unintended consequences sometimes of this foreign aid, particularly from the U.S., is the money that African governments used to spend that is now covered by aid ends up in the pockets of corrupt elites within many of these governmental systems. The other challenge with aid from abroad is also that painful reforms, fiscal reforms, efficiencies, scaling of efficiency across bureaucracies, and reduction of corruption is not adhered to because a lot of these governments know they'll get a lot of this money from abroad. So in actual fact, the irony is sometimes aid to Africa tends to reinforce bad governance and corruption because it's another conduit for fleecing the public of public funds into private pockets. But the tragedy of this situation, particularly when we talk about healthcare, is that in many cases you're dealing with the poorest of the poor who will be disproportionately affected. You're dealing with individuals who cannot care for themselves, who are desperately poor. And it's almost like you're punishing the weakest of the weak. And ultimately, unfortunately, a lot of people will die because of lack of these healthcare, you know, medications, which ironically also goes against American values and American foreign policy, which is supposed to be centered on respect for human rights and denying people the right to life because they cannot get medications because U.S. has cut aid funding to these programs. I think is quintessentially against American values.
That was David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke from New York City with viewers Douglas Mpuga. Guinea's military junta has given political parties until January 31st to hold party conventions or face a total ban from all political activities in the country. Some parties have begun holding their conventions, while others, especially major political parties, have dismissed the ultimatum. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
The Minister of Territorial Administration and Decentralization, Ibrahim Khalil Konde, says the exercise is aimed at cleaning up Guinea's political spectrum and uphold democratic achievement. He describes current political parties in Guinea as a bunch of propagandists and tribalists.
The party politique, au lieu d'être des forces de proposition, des instruments de participation à la gestion de la vie de la nation.
He says political parties in Guinea have been transformed into an instrument of propaganda and tribalism instead of being source of useful ideas and instrument for the management of daily activities. He says no democracy and state based on laws can be constructed under such an environment. Minister Khalil Konde says this is why they must agree to clean up the Guinean politics to consolidate democracy. The Minister of Territorial Administration and Decentralization has already banned over 50 political parties for lacking registration documents. It has also suspended over 150 political parties for failing to meet what it calls basic requirement to exist as a political party in Guinea. Opposition parties have described the move as nonsense and a way of imposing dictatorship on political parties in the country. Edward Sotomo, a spokesperson of the opposition coalition, says it is not up to the junta to impose party congresses on the parties. He says every political party has its own bylaws governing their activities.
As far as we are concerned, our last congress was on August of 2020 for 5 years. So we are not due, for instance, for a congress or renew our structure until August of this year, 2025. So to come out and say, well, you do it in 3 days or in 4 days, or either that or we're going to ban you completely, I think that's complete nonsense. It simply indicates that this is what they have been planning to do since a long time. They want to impose a dictatorship, and that is not going to work.
The main opposition parties have vowed not to adhere to the January 31st deadline, while their leaders are still in forceful exile imposed by the junta. Political analyst Usman Fofana says the opposition must form a common front to challenge the junta.
They should not just say we are not going to do anything. They should do something. Otherwise, the man is going to take advantage. He has made this statement because he knows he's on a very strong position as opposed to political parties.
Junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya, who seized power in 2001, promised to return the country to democratic rule at the end of December, but has failed to do so. In his New Year's message to the nation, Doumbouya says elections will be held in 2025, but without setting a date. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton, Washington, saying, have a great day, but please be safe whatever you do.
Today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.